Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond continued. Cassette 8, Side 2. Increasing white settlement led to conflicts between Cherokees and whites. When individual Cherokees robbed or assaulted white settlers and traders, the whites were unable to discriminate among the different Cherokee chiefdoms and retaliated indiscriminately against any Cherokees either by military action or by cutting off trade. In response, the Cherokee chiefdoms gradually found themselves compelled to join into a single confederacy in the course of the 18th century. Initially, the larger chiefdoms in 1730 chose an overall leader, a chief named Moytoy, who was succeeded in 1741 by his son. The first task of these leaders was to punish individual Cherokees who attacked whites and to deal with the white government. Around 1758, the Cherokees regularized their decision-making with an annual council modeled on previous village councils and meeting at one village, Echota, which thereby became a de facto capital. Eventually, the Cherokees became literate, as we saw in Chapter 12, and adopted a written constitution. The Cherokee Confederacy was thus formed not by conquest, but by the amalgamation of previously jealous smaller entities, which merged only when threatened with destruction by powerful external forces. In much the same way, in an example of state formation described in every American history textbook, the white American colonies themselves, one of which, Georgia, had precipitated the formation of the Cherokee state, were impelled to form a nation of their own when threatened with the powerful external force of the British monarchy. The American colonies were initially as jealous of their autonomy as the Cherokee chiefdoms, and their first attempt at amalgamation, under the Articles of Confederation, 1781, proved unworkable because it reserved too much autonomy to the ex-colonies. Only further threats, notably Shays's Rebellion of 1786 and the unsolved burden of war debt, overcame the ex-colonies' extreme reluctance to sacrifice autonomy and pushed them into adopting our current strong federal constitution in 1787. The 19th century unification of Germany's jealous principalities proved equally difficult. Three early attempts, the Frankfurt Parliament of 1848, the restored German Confederation of 1850, and the North German Confederation of 1866, failed before the external threat of France's declaration of war in 1870 finally led to the princelets surrendering much of their power to a central imperial German government in 1871. The other mode of formation of complex societies, besides merger under threat of external force, is merger by conquest. A well-documented example is the origin of the Zulu state in southeastern Africa. When first observed by white settlers, the Zulus were divided into dozens of little chiefdoms. During the late 1700s, as population pressure rose, fighting between the chiefdoms became increasingly intense. Among all those chiefdoms, the ubiquitous problem of devising centralized power structures was solved most successfully by a chief called Dingis Wayo, who gained ascendancy of the Mtetwa chiefdom by killing a rival around 1807. Dingis Wayo developed a superior centralized military organization by drafting young men from all villages and grouping them into regiments by age rather than by their village. He also developed superior centralized political organization by abstaining from slaughter as he conquered other chiefdoms, leaving the conquered chief's family intact and limiting himself to replacing the conquered chief himself with a relative willing to cooperate with Dingis Wayo. He developed superior centralized conflict resolution by expanding the adjudication of quarrels. In that way, Dingis Wayo was able to conquer and begin the integration of 30 other Zulu chiefdoms. His successors strengthened the resulting embryonic Zulu state by expanding its judicial system, policing, and ceremonies. This Zulu example of a state formed by conquest can be multiplied almost indefinitely. Native states whose formation from chiefdoms happened to be witnessed by Europeans in the 18th and 19th centuries include the Polynesian Hawaiian state, the Polynesian Tahitian state, the Marina state of Madagascar, Lesotho and Swazi, and other southern African states besides that of the Zulus, the Ashanti state of West Africa, and the Ankole and Buganda states of Uganda. The Aztec and Inca empires were formed by 15th century conquests, before Europeans arrived. But we know much about their formation from Indian oral histories transcribed by early Spanish settlers. The formation of the Roman state and the expansion of the Macedonian Empire under Alexander were described in detail by contemporary classical authors. All these examples illustrate that wars, or threats of war, have played a key role in most, if not all, amalgamations of societies. But wars, even between mere bands, have been a constant fact of human history. Why is it then that they evidently began causing amalgamations of societies only within the past 13,000 years? We had already concluded that the formation of complex societies is somehow linked to population pressure, so we should now seek a link between population pressure and the outcome of war. Why should wars tend to cause amalgamations of societies when populations are dense, but not when they are sparse? The answer is that the fate of defeated peoples depends on population density, with three possible outcomes. Where population densities are very low, as is usual in regions occupied by hunter-gatherer bands, survivors of a defeated group need only move farther away from their enemies. That tends to be the result of wars between nomadic bands in New Guinea and the Amazon. Where population densities are moderate, as in regions occupied by food-producing tribes, no large vacant areas remain to which survivors of a defeated band can flee. But tribal societies without intensive food production have no employment for slaves and do not produce large enough food surpluses to be able to yield much tribute. Hence, the victors have no use for survivors of a defeated tribe unless to take the women in marriage, the defeated men are killed, and their territory may be occupied by the victors. Where population densities are high, as in regions occupied by states or chiefdoms, the defeated still have nowhere to flee. But the victors now have two options for exploiting them while leaving them alive. Because chiefdoms and state societies have economic specialization, the defeated can be used as slaves, as commonly happened in biblical times. Alternatively, because many such societies have intensive food production systems capable of yielding large surpluses, the victors can leave the defeated in place, but deprive them of political autonomy, make them pay regular tribute in food or goods, and amalgamate their society into the victorious state or chiefdom. This has been the usual outcome of battles associated with the founding of states or empires throughout recorded history. For example, the Spanish conquistadores wished to exact tribute from Mexico's defeated native populations. So they were very interested in the Aztec Empire's tribute lists. It turned out that the tribute received by the Aztecs each year from subject peoples had included 7,000 tons of corn, 4,000 tons of beans, 4,000 tons of grain amaranth, 2 million cotton cloaks, and huge quantities of cacao beans, war costumes, shields, feather headdresses, and amber. Thus, food production and competition and diffusion between societies led as ultimate causes via chains of causation that differed in detail but that all involved large dense populations and sedentary living to the proximate agents of conquest, germs, writing, technology, and centralized political organization. Because those ultimate causes developed differently on different continents, so did those agents of conquest. Hence, those agents tended to arise in association with each other, but the association was not strict. For example, an empire arose without writing among the Incas, and writing with few epidemic diseases among the Aztecs. Dingis Wayo's Zulus illustrate that each of those agents contributed somewhat independently to history's pattern. Among the dozens of Zulu chiefdoms, the Mtetwa chiefdom enjoyed no advantage whatsoever of technology, writing, or germs over the other chiefdoms, which it nevertheless succeeded in defeating. Its advantage lay solely in the spheres of government and ideology. The resulting Zulu state was thereby enabled to conquer a fraction of a continent for nearly a century. Part 4, Around the World in 5 Chapters. Chapter 15, Yali's People. When my wife Marie and I were vacationing in Australia one summer, we decided to visit a site with well-preserved Aboriginal rock paintings in the desert near the town of Menindee. While I knew of the Australian desert's reputation for dryness and summer heat, I had already spent long periods working under hot, dry conditions in the Californian desert and New Guinea savanna. So I considered myself experienced enough to deal with the minor challenges we would face as tourists in Australia. Carrying plenty of drinking water, Marie and I set off at noon on a hike of a few miles to the paintings. The trail from the ranger station led uphill, under a cloudless sky, through open terrain offering no shade whatsoever. The hot, dry air that we were breathing reminded me of how it felt to breathe while sitting in a Finnish sauna. By the time we reached the cliffside with the paintings, we had finished our water. We had also lost our interest in art, so we pushed on uphill, breathing slowly and regularly. Presently, I noticed a bird that was unmistakably a species of babbler, but it seemed enormous compared with any known babbler species. At that point, I realized that I was experiencing heat hallucinations for the first time in my life. Marie and I decided that we had better head straight back. Both of us stopped talking. As we walked, we concentrated on listening to our breathing, calculating the distance to the next landmark, and estimating the remaining time. My mouth and tongue were now dry, and Marie's face was red. When we at last reached the air-conditioned ranger station, we sagged into chairs next to the water cooler, drank down the cooler's last half-gallon of water, and asked the ranger for another bottle. Sitting there exhausted both physically and emotionally, I reflected that the Aborigines who had made those paintings had somehow spent their entire lives in that desert, without air-conditioned retreats, managing to find food as well as water. To white Australians, Menindee is famous as the base camp for two whites who had suffered worse from the desert's dry heat over a century earlier, the Irish policeman Robert Burke and the English astronomer William Wills, ill-fated leaders of the first European expedition to cross Australia from south to north. Setting out with six camels packing food enough for 3 months, Burke and Wills ran out of provisions while in the desert north of Menindee. Three successive times they encountered and were rescued by well-fed Aborigines whose home was that desert, and who plied the explorers with fish, fern cakes, and roasted fat rats. But then Burke foolishly shot his pistol at one of the Aborigines, whereupon the whole group fled. Despite their big advantage over the Aborigines in possessing guns with which to hunt, Burke and Wills starved, collapsed, and died within a month after the Aborigines' departure. My wife's and my experience at Menindee and the fate of Burke and Wills made vivid for me the difficulties of building a human society in Australia. Australia stands out from all the other continents. The differences between Eurasia, Africa, North America, and South America fade into insignificance compared with the differences between Australia and any of those other land masses. Australia is by far the driest, smallest, flattest, most infertile, climatically most unpredictable, and biologically most impoverished continent. It was the last continent to be occupied by Europeans. Until then, it had supported the most distinctive human societies and the least numerous human population of any continent. Australia thus provides a crucial test of theories about intercontinental differences in societies. It had the most distinctive environment and also the most distinctive societies. Did the former cause the latter? If so, how? Australia is the logical continent with which to begin our Around the World tour, applying the lessons of Parts 2 and 3 to understanding the differing histories of all the continents. Most lay people would describe as the most salient feature of native Australian societies their seeming backwardness. Australia is the sole continent where, in modern times, all native peoples still lived without any of the hallmarks of so-called civilization. Without farming, herding, metal, bows and arrows, substantial buildings, settled villages, writing, chiefdoms, or states. Instead, Australian Aborigines were nomadic or semi-nomadic hunter-gatherers, organized into bands, living in temporary shelters or huts, and still dependent on stone tools. During the last 13,000 years, less cultural change has accumulated in Australia than in any other continent. The prevalent European view of native Australians was already typified by the words of an early French explorer who wrote, They are the most miserable people of the world, and the human beings who approach closest to brute beasts. Yet, as of 40,000 years ago, Native Australian societies enjoyed a big head start over societies of Europe and the other continents. Native Australians developed some of the earliest known stone tools with ground edges, the earliest hafted stone tools, that is, stone axe heads mounted on handles, and by far the earliest watercraft in the world. Some of the oldest known painting on rock surfaces comes from Australia. Anatomically modern humans may have settled Australia before they settled Western Europe. Why, despite that head start, did Europeans end up conquering Australia rather than vice versa? Within that question lies another. During the Pleistocene ice ages, when much ocean water was sequestered in continental ice sheets and sea level dropped far below its present stand, the shallow Arafura Sea, now separating Australia from New Guinea, was low, dry land. With the melting of ice sheets between around 12,000 and 8,000 years ago, sea level rose, that lowland became flooded, and the former continent of Greater Australia became sundered into the two hemicontinents of Australia and New Guinea. The human societies of those two formerly joined landmasses were in modern times very different from each other. In contrast to everything that I just said about Native Australians, most New Guineans, such as Yali's people, were farmers and swineherds. They lived in settled villages and were organized politically into tribes rather than bands. All New Guineans had bows and arrows, and many used pottery. New Guineans tended to have much more substantial dwellings, more seaworthy boats, and more numerous and more varied utensils than did Australians. As a consequence of being food producers instead of hunter-gatherers, New Guineans lived at much higher average population densities than Australians. New Guinea has only one-tenth of Australia's area, but supported a native population several times that of Australia's. Why did the human societies of the larger landmass derived from Pleistocene Greater Australia remain so backward in their development, while the societies of the smaller landmass advanced much more rapidly? Why didn't all those New Guinea innovations spread to Australia, which is separated from New Guinea by only 90 miles of sea at Torres Strait? From the perspective of cultural anthropology, the geographic distance between Australia and New Guinea is even less than 90 miles, because Torres Strait is sprinkled with islands inhabited by farmers using bows and arrows and culturally resembling New Guineans. The largest Torres Strait island lies only 10 miles from Australia. Islanders carried on a lively trade with native Australians as well as with New Guineans. How could two such different cultural universes maintain themselves across a calm strait only 10 miles wide and routinely traversed by canoes? Compared with native Australians, New Guineans rate as culturally advanced. But most other modern people consider even New Guineans backward. Until Europeans began to colonize New Guinea in the late 19th century, all New Guineans were non-literate, dependent on stone tools, and politically not yet organized into states or, with a few exceptions, chiefdoms. Granted that New Guineans had progressed beyond native Australians, why had they not yet progressed as far as many Eurasians, Africans, and Native Americans? Thus, Yali's people and their Australian cousins pose a puzzle inside a puzzle. When asked to account for the cultural backwardness of Aboriginal Australian society, many white Australians have a simple answer: supposed deficiencies of the Aborigines themselves. In facial structure and skin color, Aborigines certainly look different from Europeans, leading some late 19th century authors to consider them a missing link between apes and humans. How else can one account for the fact that white English colonists created a literate food-producing industrial democracy within a few decades of colonizing a continent whose inhabitants, after more than 40,000 years, were still non-literate hunter-gatherers? It is especially striking that Australia has some of the world's richest iron and aluminum deposits, as well as rich reserves of copper, tin, lead, and zinc. Why then were native Australians still ignorant of metal tools and living in the Stone Age? It seems like a perfectly controlled experiment in the evolution of human societies. The continent was the same, only the people were different. Ergo, The explanation for the differences between Native Australians and European Australian societies must lie in the different people composing them. The logic behind this racist conclusion appears compelling. We shall see, however, that it contains a simple error. As the first step in examining this logic, let us examine the origins of the peoples themselves. Australia and New Guinea were both occupied by at least 40,000 years ago, at a time when they were both still joined as Greater Australia. A glance at a map suggests that the colonists must have originated ultimately from the nearest continent, Southeast Asia, by island hopping through the Indonesian archipelago. This conclusion is supported by genetic relationships between modern Australians, New Guineans, and Asians, and by the survival today of a few populations of somewhat similar physical appearance in the Philippines, Malay Peninsula, and Andaman Islands off Myanmar. Once the colonists had reached the shores of Greater Australia, they spread quickly over the whole continent to occupy even its farthest reaches and most inhospitable habitats. By 40,000 years ago, fossils and stone tools attest to their presence in Australia's southwestern corner. By 35,000 years ago, in Australia's southeastern corner and Tasmania, the corner of Australia most remote from the colonists' likely beachhead in Western Australia or New Guinea, the parts nearest Indonesia and Asia, and by 30,000 years ago, in the cold New Guinea highlands. All of those areas could have been reached overland from a western beachhead. However, the colonization of both the Bismarck and the Solomon archipelagos northeast of New Guinea by 35,000 years ago required further overwater crossings of dozens of miles. The occupation could have been even more rapid than that apparent spread of dates from 40,000 to 30,000 years ago, since the various dates hardly differ within the experimental error of the radiocarbon method. At the Pleistocene times, when Australia and New Guinea were initially occupied, the Asian continent extended eastward to incorporate the modern islands of Borneo, Java, and Bali, nearly 1,000 miles nearer to Australia and New Guinea than Southeast Asia's present margin. However, at least 8 channels up to 50 miles wide still remained to be crossed in getting from Borneo or Bali to Pleistocene Greater Australia. 40,000 years ago, those crossings may have been achieved by bamboo rafts, low-tech but seaworthy watercraft still in use in coastal South China today. The crossings must nevertheless have been difficult, because after that initial landfall by 40,000 years ago, the archaeological record provides no compelling evidence of further human arrivals in Greater Australia from Asia for tens of thousands of years. Not until within the last few thousand years do we encounter the next firm evidence in the form of the appearance of Asian-derived pigs in New Guinea and Asian-derived dogs in Australia. Thus, the human societies of Australia and New Guinea developed in substantial isolation from the Asian societies that founded them. That isolation is reflected in languages spoken today. After all those millennia of isolation, neither modern Aboriginal Australian languages nor the major group of modern New Guinea languages, the so-called Papuan languages, exhibit any clear relationships with any modern Asian languages. The isolation is also reflected in genes and physical anthropology. Genetic studies suggest that Aboriginal Australians and New Guinea Highlanders are somewhat more similar to modern Asians than to peoples of other continents, but the relationship is not a close one. In skeletons and physical appearance, Aboriginal Australians and New Guineans are also distinct from most Southeast Asian populations, as becomes obvious if one compares photos of Australians or New Guineans with those of Indonesians or Chinese. Part of the reason for all these differences is that the initial Asian colonists of Greater Australia have had a long time in which to diverge from their stay-at-home Asian cousins, with only limited genetic exchanges during most of that time. But probably a more important reason is that the original Southeast Asian stock from which the colonists of Greater Australia were derived has by now been largely replaced by other Asians expanding out of China. Aboriginal Australians and New Guineans have also diverged genetically, physically, and linguistically from each other. For instance, among the major genetically determined human blood groups, groups B of the so-called ABO system and S of the MNS system occur in New Guinea as well as in most of the rest of the world. but both are virtually absent in Australia. The tightly coiled hair of most New Guineans contrasts with the straight or wavy hair of most Australians. Australian languages and New Guinea's Papuan languages are unrelated, not only to Asian languages, but also to each other, except for some spread of vocabulary in both directions across Torres Strait. All that divergence of Australians and New Guineans from each other reflects lengthy isolation in very different environments. Since the rise of the Arafura Sea finally separated Australia and New Guinea from each other around 10,000 years ago, gene exchange has been limited to tenuous contact via the chain of Torres Strait Islands. That has allowed the populations of the two hemicontinents to adapt to their own environments. While the savannas and mangroves of coastal southern New Guinea are fairly similar to those of northern Australia, other habitats of the hemicontinents differ in almost all major respects. Here are some of the differences. New Guinea lies nearly on the equator, while Australia extends far into the temperate zones, reaching almost 40 degrees south of the equator. New Guinea is mountainous and extremely rugged, rising to 16,500 feet and with glaciers capping the highest peaks, while Australia is mostly low and flat. 94% of its area lies below 2,000 feet of elevation. New Guinea is one of the wettest areas on Earth, Australia one of the driest. Most of New Guinea receives over 100 inches of rain annually, and much of the highlands receives over 200 inches, while most of Australia receives less than 20 inches. New Guinea's equatorial climate varies only modestly from season to season and year to year. But Australia's climate is highly seasonal and varies from year to year far more than that of any other continent. As a result, New Guinea is laced with permanent large rivers, while Australia's permanently flowing rivers are confined in most years to eastern Australia, and even Australia's largest river system, the Murray Darling, has ceased flowing for months during droughts. Most of New Guinea's land area is clothed in dense rainforest, while most of Australia's supports only desert and open dry woodland. New Guinea is covered with young fertile soil as a consequence of volcanic activity, glaciers repeatedly advancing and retreating and scouring the highlands, and mountain streams carrying huge quantities of silt to the lowlands. In contrast, Australia has by far the oldest, most infertile, most nutrient-leached soils of any continent, because of Australia's little volcanic activity and its lack of high mountains and glaciers. Despite having only one-tenth of Australia's area, New Guinea is home to approximately as many mammal and bird species as is Australia, a result of New Guinea's equatorial location, much higher rainfall, much greater range of elevations, and greater fertility. All of those environmental differences influenced the two hemicontinents' very disparate cultural histories, which we shall now consider. The earliest and most intensive food production and the densest populations of Greater Australia arose in the highland valleys of New Guinea at altitudes between 4,000 and 9,000 feet above sea level. Archaeological excavations uncovered complex systems of drainage ditches dating back to 9,000 years ago and becoming extensive by 6,000 years ago, as well as terraces serving to retain soil moisture in drier areas. The ditch systems were similar to those still used today in the highlands to drain swampy areas for use as gardens. By around 5,000 years ago, pollen analyses testify to widespread deforestation of highland valleys, suggesting forest clearance for agriculture. Today, the staple crops of highland agriculture are the recently introduced sweet potato, along with taro, bananas, yams, sugarcane, edible grass stems, and several leafy vegetables. Because taro, bananas, and yams are native to Southeast Asia, an undoubted site of plant domestication, it used to be assumed that New Guinea highland crops other than sweet potatoes arrived from Asia. However, it was eventually realized that the wild ancestors of sugarcane, the leafy vegetables, and the edible grass stems are New Guinea species, that the particular types of bananas grown in New Guinea have New Guinea rather than Asian wild ancestors, and that taro and some yams are native to New Guinea as well as to Asia. If New Guinea agriculture had really had Asian origins, One might have expected to find Highland crops derived unequivocally from Asia, but there are none. For those reasons, it is now generally acknowledged that agriculture arose indigenously in the New Guinea Highlands by domestication of New Guinea wild plant species. New Guinea thus joins the Fertile Crescent, China, and a few other regions as one of the world's centers of independent origins of plant domestication. No remains of the crops actually being grown in the highlands 6,000 years ago have been preserved in archaeological sites. However, that is not surprising, because modern highland staple crops are plant species that do not leave archaeologically visible residues except under exceptional conditions. Hence, it seems likely that some of them were also the founding crops of highland agriculture, especially as the ancient drainage systems preserved are so similar to the modern drainage systems used for growing taro. The three unequivocally foreign elements in New Guinea Highland food production as seen by the first European explorers were chickens, pigs, and sweet potatoes. Chickens and pigs were domesticated in Southeast Asia and introduced around 3,600 years ago to New Guinea and most other Pacific islands by Austronesians, a people of ultimately South Chinese origin, whom we shall discuss in Chapter 17. Pigs may have arrived earlier. As for the sweet potato, native to South America, it apparently reached New Guinea only within the last few centuries following its introduction to the Philippines by Spaniards. Once established in New Guinea, the sweet potato overtook taro as the highlands' leading crop. Because of its shorter time required to reach maturity, higher yields per acre, and greater tolerance of poor soil conditions. The development of New Guinea highland agriculture must have triggered a big population explosion thousands of years ago, because the highlands could have supported only very low population densities of hunter-gatherers after New Guinea's original megafauna of giant marsupials had been exterminated. The arrival of the sweet potato triggered a further explosion in recent centuries. When Europeans first flew over the highlands in the 1930s, they were astonished to see below them a landscape similar to Holland's. Broad valleys were completely deforested and dotted with villages, and drained and fenced fields for intensive food production covered entire valley floors. That landscape testifies to the population densities achieved in the highlands by farmers with stone tools. Steep terrain, persistent cloud cover, malaria, and risk of drought at lower elevations confine New Guinea highland agriculture to elevations above about 4,000 feet. In effect, the New Guinea highlands are an island of dense farming populations thrust up into the sky and surrounded below by a sea of clouds. Lowland New Guineans on the seacoast and rivers are villagers depending heavily on fish, while those on dry ground away from the coast and rivers subsist at low densities by slash-and-burn agriculture based on bananas and yams, supplemented by hunting and gathering. In contrast, lowland New Guinea swamp dwellers live as nomadic hunter-gatherers, dependent on the starchy pith of wild sago palms, which are very productive and yield three times more calories per hour of work than does gardening. New Guinea swamps thus provide a clear instance of an environment where people remained hunter-gatherers because farming could not compete with the hunting-gathering lifestyle. The sago eaters persisting in lowland swamps exemplify the nomadic hunter-gatherer band organization that must formerly have characterized all New Guineans. For all the reasons that we discussed in chapters 13 and 14, the farmers and the fishing peoples were the ones to develop more complex technology, societies, and political organization. They live in permanent villages and tribal societies, often led by a big man. Some of them construct large, elaborately decorated ceremonial houses. Their great art, in the form of wooden statues and masks, is prized in museums around the world. New Guinea thus became the part of Greater Australia with the most advanced technology, social and political organization, and art. However, from an urban American or European perspective, New Guinea still rates as primitive rather than advanced. Why did New Guineans continue to use stone tools instead of developing metal tools, remain non-literate, and fail to organize themselves into chiefdoms and states? It turns out that New Guinea had several biological and geographic strikes against it. First, although indigenous food production did arise in the New Guinea highlands, We saw in Chapter 8 that it yielded little protein. The dietary staples were low-protein root crops, and production of the sole domesticated animal species, pigs and chickens, was too low to contribute much to people's protein budgets. Since neither pigs nor chickens can be harnessed to pull carts, Highlanders remained without sources of power other than human muscle power, and also failed to evolve epidemic diseases to repel the eventual European invaders. A second restriction on the size of Highland populations was the limited available area. The New Guinea Highlands have only a few broad valleys, notably the Wagi and Baliem valleys, capable of supporting dense populations. Still a third limitation was the reality that the mid-montane zone, between 4,000 and 9,000 feet, was the sole altitudinal zone in New Guinea suitable for intensive food production. There was no food production at all in New Guinea alpine habitats above 9,000 feet, little on the hill slopes between 4,000 and 1,000 feet, and only low-density slash-and-burn agriculture in the lowlands. Thus, large-scale economic exchanges of food between communities at different altitudes, specializing in different types of food production, never developed in New Guinea. Such exchanges in the Andes, Alps, and Himalayas not only increased population densities in those areas by providing people at all altitudes with a more balanced diet, but also promoted regional economic and political integration. For all these reasons, the population of traditional New Guinea never exceeded 1 million until European colonial governments brought Western medicine and the end of intertribal warfare. Of the approximately 9 world centers of agricultural origins that we discussed in Chapter 5, New Guinea remained the one with by far the smallest population. With a mere 1 million people, New Guinea could not develop the technology, writing, and political systems that arose among populations of tens of millions in China, the Fertile Crescent, the Andes, and Mesoamerica. New Guinea's population is not only small in aggregate, but also fragmented into thousands of micropopulations by the rugged terrain, swamps in much of the lowlands, steep-sided ridges and narrow canyons alternating with each other in the highlands, and dense jungle swathing both the lowlands and the highlands. When I am engaged in biological exploration in New Guinea, with teams of New Guineans as field assistants, I consider excellent progress to be 3 miles per day, even if we are traveling over existing trails. Most Highlanders in traditional New Guinea never went more than 10 miles from home in the course of their lives. Those difficulties of terrain combined with the state of intermittent warfare that characterized relations between New Guinea bands or villages account for traditional New Guinea's linguistic, cultural, and political fragmentation. New Guinea has by far the highest concentration of languages in the world, 1,000 out of the world's 6,000 languages, crammed into an area only slightly larger than that of Texas, and divided into dozens of language families and isolated languages as different from each other as English is from Chinese. Nearly half of all New Guinea languages have fewer than 500 speakers, and even the largest language groups, still with a mere 100,000 speakers, were politically fragmented into hundreds of villages, fighting as fiercely with each other as with speakers of other languages. Each of those micro-societies alone was far too small to support chiefs and craft specialists, or to develop metallurgy and writing. Besides a small and fragmented population, the other limitation on development in New Guinea was geographic isolation, restricting the inflow of technology and ideas from elsewhere. New Guinea's three neighbors were all separated from New Guinea by water gaps, and until a few thousand years ago, they were all even less advanced than New Guinea, especially the New Guinea Highlands, in technology and food production. Of those three neighbors, Aboriginal Australians remained hunter-gatherers with almost nothing to offer New Guineans that New Guineans did not already possess. New Guinea's second neighbor was the much smaller islands of the Bismarck and the Solomon Archipelagos to the east. That left as New Guinea's third neighbor the islands of eastern Indonesia, but that area too remained a cultural backwater occupied by hunter-gatherers for most of its history. There is no item that can be identified as having reached New Guinea via Indonesia after the initial colonization of New Guinea over 40,000 years ago, until the time of the Austronesian expansion around 1600 BC. With that expansion, Indonesia became occupied by food producers of Asian origins, with domestic animals, with agriculture and technology at least as complex as New Guinea's, and with navigational skills that served as a much more efficient conduit from Asia to New Guinea. Austronesians settled on islands west and north and east of New Guinea, and in the far west and on the north and southeast coasts of New Guinea itself. Austronesians introduced pottery, chickens, and probably dogs and pigs to New Guinea. Early archaeological surveys claimed pig bones in the New Guinea highlands by 4000 BC, but those claims have not been confirmed. For at least the last 1,000 years, trade connected New Guinea to the technologically much more advanced societies of Java and China. In return for exporting bird-of-paradise plumes and spices, New Guineans received Southeast Asian goods, including even such luxury items as Dongsun bronze drums and Chinese porcelain. With time, the Austronesian expansion would surely have had more impact on New Guinea. Western New Guinea would eventually have been incorporated politically into the sultanates of eastern Indonesia, and metal tools might have spread through eastern Indonesia to New Guinea. But that hadn't happened by AD 1511, the year the Portuguese arrived in the Moluccas and truncated Indonesia's separate train of developments. When Europeans reached New Guinea soon thereafter, its inhabitants were still living in bands or in fiercely independent little villages and still using stone tools. While the New Guinea hemicontinent of Greater Australia thus developed both animal husbandry and agriculture, the Australian hemicontinent developed neither. During the Ice Ages, Australia had supported even more big marsupials than New Guinea, including diprotodonts, the marsupial equivalent of cows and rhinoceroses, giant kangaroos, and giant wombats. But all those marsupial candidates for animal husbandry disappeared in the wave of extinctions or exterminations that accompanied human colonization of Australia. That left Australia, like New Guinea, with no domesticable native mammals. The sole foreign domesticated mammal adopted in Australia was the dog, which arrived from Asia presumably in Austronesian canoes around 1500 BC and established itself in the wild in Australia to become the dingo. Native Australians kept captive dingoes as companions, watchdogs, and even as living blankets, giving rise to the expression five-dog night, to mean a very cold night. But they did not use dingoes, dogs, for food, as did Polynesians, or for cooperative hunting of wild animals, as did New Guineans. Agriculture was another non-starter in Australia, which is not only the driest continent, but also the one with the most infertile soils. In addition, Australia is unique in that the overwhelming influence on climate over most of the continent is an irregular non-annual cycle, the ENSO, acronym for El Niño Southern Oscillation, rather than the regular annual cycle of the seasons so familiar in most other parts of the world. Unpredictable severe droughts last for years, punctuated by equally unpredictable torrential rains and floods. Even today, with Eurasian crops and with trucks and railroads to transport produce, food production in Australia remains a risky business. Herds build up in good years, only to be killed off by drought. Any incipient farmers in Aboriginal Australia would have faced similar cycles in their own populations. If in good years they had settled in villages, grown crops, and produced babies, those large populations would have starved and died off in drought years when the land could support far fewer people. The other major obstacle to the development of food production in Australia was the paucity of domesticable wild plants. Even modern European plant geneticists have failed to develop any crop except macadamia nuts from Australia's native wild flora. The list of the world's potential prize cereals, the 56 wild grass species with the heaviest grains, include only two Australian species, both of which rank near the bottom of the list, grain weight only 13 milligrams compared with a whopping 40 milligrams for the heaviest grains elsewhere in the world. That's not to say that Australia had no potential crops at all, or that Aboriginal Australians would never have developed indigenous food production. Some plants, such as certain species of yams, taro, and arrowroot, are cultivated in southern New Guinea, but also grow wild in northern Australia, and were gathered by Aborigines there. As we shall see, Aborigines in the climatically most favorable areas of Australia were evolving in a direction that might have eventuated in food production. This book is continued on cassette 9, side 1.